Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At Sephora, we know how you love to use makeup, skincare, hair care, and fragrances that work for you, but also how important it is to be in the know about the ingredients that are in them, which is why we created Clean at Sephora. Curated products from brands like Merit, Amika, Summer Fridays, and Fleur that have everything you want, minus certain ingredients you might not. Clean at Sephora is only at Sephora. Shop now at Sephora.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Martin Dean, historian and researcher, about his new book, Investigating Babinyar, Shadows from the Valley of Death. Investigating Babinyar is built on research conducted by Martin into arguably the deadliest shooting massacre ever. On September 29th and 30th of 1941, Nazi soldiers and police battalions shot and killed more than 33,000 Jewish civilians in the Babinyar Ravine in Kiev. Due to the Nazi cover-up and Soviet Union's de-emphasis on the Jewish identity of the victims, many details of the massacre have been buried over time. Martin and a team of researchers employing various methods from aerial photography to 3D modeling have reconstructed this horrific event. Martin, thank you for joining me today to discuss Investigating Babinyar.
Thanks, Kat. It's great to be with you, and I look forward to discussing this.
You've done some really important work. It's obviously, reading it was very difficult. I think you're talking about such a horrific event, but it's of course really important to remember these events and to reconstruct them so we know exactly what happened. But I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book.
So it was a long journey, and actually all of my books are not books where I sat down like with my PhD and said I just want to write a book about this topic. It sort of came to me through different channels. And only once I'd done the research did I realize, oh, this is the way I want to tell the story. This is how the book should be. So it's kind of been a work in progress, and it's just started out as an investigation initially. My background is that I'm from the UK, and I did a PhD in history at Queen's College, Cambridge. And then after that, I worked actually about 10 years as a war crimes investigator, both in Australia with the Special Investigations Unit and as the senior historian for the Metropolitan War Police war crimes unit in London. And all those investigations were dealing with basically what we now call the Sher by bullets, mass shootings in the occupied Soviet Union by Nazi, not only German units, but also collaborationist units, actually. And after that, I did work for a while for the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and wrote a couple of books there, including one called Robbing the Jews that won a National Jewish Book Award. And then in 2017, I was asked by Carol Beckhoff, the chief historian of the Babinyar Holocaust Memorial Center, to join his team and conduct some research at Babinyar. Actually, I hadn't really studied the topic very much before. I'd written about many other massacres, including a ghettos encyclopedia, so I'm familiar with more than 1,000 sites of mass shootings in Eastern Europe. But this was the first time I really looked closely at Babinyar, and I was kind of struck that there were kind of large elements of the story that were not very well known or well explained. There was even disputes among historians about where the massacre actually took place. And Carol suggested a new approach, which I really embraced, which was to combine ground photographs, including quite a few new ones that had only been found in the 1990s or more recently, together with aerial photography, and use sort of more modern geolocation techniques to try and find out more about what the topography was like at the time, how that influenced the massacre, and especially where certain key events took place. And so we sort of broke the massacre up into little pieces. And I did research on little corners where important things took place. Like there were pictures where Jews were forced to undress. We couldn't figure out exactly where this was. Eventually, we discovered that actually, not on the maps, but from the aerial photography, there was a sand quarry right next to what was probably the main site of the massacre. And then the more we compared the witness testimony, which there was actually quite a lot of, with these ground photographs and aerial photographs, the more we could sort of piece together the puzzle. But it literally broke down into sort of 10 or 15 different separate locations where key things happened. And then you can sort of see that this was not just a mass shooting, but a very sort of carefully coordinated event where the victims were forced to march along a specific route. Some were also taken by truck. But piecing it together was a real detective job that I kind of enjoyed the challenge of, despite the horrific nature of the substance.
Yeah, reading the introduction was interesting because you clearly did work that you might not necessarily see a historian doing, not the same type of just archival work that you usually find in historical work. What was it like working in these other disciplines, doing aerial photography?
Yeah, that was a real challenge because it is kind of a technical thing, like a hangover from World War II. I actually worked with a colleague, Willy Gottlieb Matyszewski, who tried to use the same techniques that they used in World War II, even using sort of stereoscopic analysis. In the end, I found my own eyesight was not able to do that. So I kind of did it without the stereoscopic aspect. But it was surprising to find out that there were all these aerial photographs taken of Babyn Yar. Some of them actually quite close to the date of massacre. We had one just before, and then the next most detailed ones were in 1943. But they also, by accident, really caught a key event in the history of Babyn Yar. They showed us where the camp for the exhumation squad was based. And so certainly without the aerial photography, we wouldn't have been able to solve a lot of these puzzles. So that was definitely an important aspect of it. And also having photographs that hadn't really been analyzed before was very important. But it was still very difficult to work out where the photographs were taken. And strangely, there was like a lone tree on the skyline, which I used as a reference point. And I was lucky in some ways, too, that I had kind of a more professional team following up on my work. We had two different experts in kind of geolocation and 3D models who then used the same images, and they could kind of confirm my kind of unprofessional estimation by literally kind of superimposing the various images together to create a 3D model of the whole area. And that definitely corroborated kind of my initial interpretation.
So the massacre occurred in late September of 1941. Can you discuss the months, the lead up to the massacre? What was the situation like in Kiev?
Yes, so not only in Kiev, but throughout the Eastern Front, the mass shooting of Jewish men, women, and children just evolved gradually, so that the Holocaust by bullets didn't start on June the 22nd. Almost immediately, they were shooting adult male Jews, and this was particularly done by the Einsatzgruppen, but by other units like the Waffen-SS, even some collaborationist units like the Ares Commando were involved. But then in the summer, especially first in Lithuania and then in other places, you see the expansion to ever larger numbers of Jews, and then it particularly to women and children, to which there was a little bit of resistance among the shooters themselves. So that was kind of introduced gradually. And then the first really large mass shooting, particularly where these units from Einsatzgruppe C were involved, was at Kamenets-Podolsk, so to the west of Kiev, about a month earlier. And then some of the same personnel were involved both there and in Kiev, particularly Yakon was in charge of both those as the higher SS and police commander. And so you do see also an evolution in the tactics used, whereas initially they would use more like a firing squad technique. Certainly by August and September, they started to use what's sometimes called the sardine packing method, which is where you literally get the victims to lie down on top of each other to try and get as many people into the mass grave as possible. And these are fairly horrific details that they're not described very much by the witnesses, of course, because so few people who actually got into the mass grave survived. But there were testimonies by one or two of the shooters as well, which help us to kind of piece the whole story together. And that's another interesting part of the story is that especially the German trials in the 1960s and early 1970s, You had a lot of witnesses willing to say what happened because they were more or less felt safe that they were only going to be charging the leaders with any kind of war crime. So some of the people lower down the chain admitted to their culpability. And even describe things. Although there was a lack of detail, mainly because most people were really just there for that one day, so they couldn't remember the sort of details I was looking for. So I relied on a few accurate memories of drivers and one or two of the local witnesses to really help me best to piece together the topography.
So, you know, this question I have just about what happened on September 29th and 30th of 1941, you know, could you describe... obviously, we'll get into some of the details too, but you know, and you know, this it is just horrific, the actual events and how they unfold. So, a fair warning to listeners: could you just tell a little bit about how the actual event took place, what we know about what occurred?
Right. Well, with the book, actually, I sort of circle around the main core of the event quite a bit and only have one or two chapters dealing with sort of the final actual shooting process. It's more about the organization and partly also the perception of the victims, how they gradually realize themselves what's going on. And that is also sort of quite disturbing, but in some ways also gripping as you kind of gradually realize it yourself. This is how it was organized. What happened very briefly is that the German authorities put up posters using the Ukrainian police to some extent as well to asking all the Jews to report to a certain part of Kiev to the west, close to the cemeteries. But there was also a large freight railway station nearby, so many of the Jews thought that they would be just resettled somewhere else by rail, and that was also kind of encouraged by the German authorities. And in the morning of the 29th, thousands of Jews did take to the streets, but others were kind of hauled out of their homes by German policemen mainly. A few were transported by truck, or I think the majority did go on foot to the initial collection point. And what you see is there is kind of a point of no return where none of the non-Jews escorting the Jews was supposed to go any further. A few non-Jews did go further, and even some of those were shot with the Jews. So it's kind of shows it was a risky thing even to accompany them. But the real way that the Jews were distinguished from the non-Jews was by their documentation. They had a Jewish nationality in their passports. And there was a point along the route where these documents were examined, and we even have a photograph with kind of piles of documents on the ground. Another witness talks about the passports actually being sort of burned in front of people's eyes. And so there were several stations like this on the way where specific things happened. We have other pictures of piles of property along a narrow kind of avenue of trees. And it's such an enormous site, these literally hundreds of meters of initially just suitcases piled up, or in fact, a lot of them just had kind of sacks that they carried over their shoulders with basic belongings in them. And you can see on the faces of the Jews as they're walking along, sort of on the one hand, they're sort of very resolute and grim and determined. But on the other hand, you don't really get the impression that they know that they're going to be killed. So it's still kind of going on in an orderly fashion. This gets more chaotic as it gets closer to the event. At some stage, they do start to hear some shots in the distance, and some people who even left before the initial checkpoint say they either heard that from other people or could just vaguely hear it themselves. And once they get towards the sand quarry where the undressing takes place, the policemen are forming a narrow corridor to sort of push people along, keep them moving, and using a lot of brutality and dogs to force them along. And the undressing phase is also particularly disturbing. It's described by a few of the surviving witnesses. I won't talk about the mass shooting itself anymore, but the topography was still very difficult to recreate because the ravine itself consists of a sort of network of narrow channels, and there were at least two possible sites identified by historians. And a misleading thing was the Soviet memorial, which was built in the 1970s, which is quite a bit south of the actual events. And closer to the Christian cemeteries there. Eventually, we could definitely identify the shooting site, mainly from the testimonies of the exhumation prisoners, but also from the photographs. There is one key photograph that shows Soviet POWs filling in the grave site. And as I say, with the help of aerial photographs, locating the quarry and also using the lone tree in the distance, I was able to confirm that beyond any reasonable doubt. There's even a post-war a short film with a survivor pointing to exactly that spot as where the shooting took place.
So of the 33,000, who were the primary victims? Obviously, most of them were Jewish, but can you tell me a little bit about, you know, their gender, their age?
Right. So there was quite a large evacuation of Jews from Kiev before the mass shooting. As many as 200,000 Jews were probably living there in the summer of 1941, although, of course, the adult males of military age were mostly conscripted just before or during the initial invasion period. Others did manage to get out either because they were relatives or particularly members of key war industries that were evacuated. One or two even kind of volunteered for either kind of trench digging or nursing services just before the Germans arrived. But as the Germans got closer, it became harder and harder for anyone to get out because suddenly Kiev is in the middle of a huge pocket, and even some of the Soviet military can't escape from the kind of German trap around them. And there's actually not much fighting at all in Kiev when the Germans initially arrive. But within the first 4 or 5 days, you then have massive explosions in some of the key buildings in the center of the city, which are actually organized by the Soviet security forces. And this is really what the German security police and the army together use as an excuse for what is their massive reprisal, shooting as many Jews as they can grab. So by this time, most of the victims are women and children and elderly men, but there were some men of younger age who were mostly POWs who'd been captured, or a few others who were ordered to report initially to a POW camp in the south of the city, so near the railway station. And those men, some of them were actually shot the day before or either during or after the main massacre, but they were taken there by truck and may well have been shot in a separate trench, slightly apart from the main massacre. It's disputed how many Red Army soldiers were shot altogether at Babyn Yar, and that's really the main a kind of unknown element in estimating the total number shot. I see it as being a minimum of around 55 to 60,000, probably as many as 70,000. Most people see a kind of overall figure more like 100,000, but that's based mainly on Soviet sources, which don't really explain who these kind of extra people who weren't Jewish were. And it does depend a lot where they shot. I mean, a lot of Red Army soldiers were shot in and around Kiev, but we don't have kind of evidence from many of them escaping or even been taken to Babyn Yar to be shot. So although there is description of a large trench where as many as 20,000 Red Army soldiers were killed, I'm just not seeing some other corroboration for exactly who that was. So it may well have been quite a few less than that number.
When did the crimes committed in Babyn Yar first start to become clear? When was the Soviet Union and the rest of the Allies aware of what had happened?
So word does get out relatively quickly in places as far away as Switzerland and other countries. I didn't investigate this in great detail. It has been done by others before. But even in the German army, word was getting around not only that many people had been shot, but even that the graves had been covered up using explosives just afterwards. So I have a chapter on that aspect of the crime. And there are numerous different German accounts of sort of hearsay people in Kiev. They didn't actually go out to Babyn Yar, but someone had told them that there was a big grave somewhere and the sides had been blown up to cover it over. So word did get around. The Allies were obviously a little suspicious of this. The Soviets had more detailed knowledge because people came across the lines from Kiev, but almost the whole population of Kiev was fairly aware that something dreadful had happened. And I also quote a diary there that within 2 or 3 days, it was clear to most of the population of Kiev that the Jews of Kiev were no more.
Can you tell me a little bit about Paul Blobel, the man most responsible for the massacre?
He was the head of what's called Sonderkommando 4A, which was part of Einsatzgruppe C. He was a strict disciplinarian, and we get the reports already on the route towards Kiev that he more or less forces all members of the commando to take part in shootings, including young Waffen-SS men who've arrived only quite late. They've all been a part in some way of mass shootings before they get to Kiev. And he does have a drinking problem, so even he was to some extent affected by the awful job he was given. But he does stay more or less with the security police, and later he's also given the task of exhuming the corpses, not only in Kiev, but really all over Eastern Europe. This is a large part of the Holocaust that was relatively neglected until recently. There's an excellent book by Andriy Angrick, which is about 1,000 pages. I can reassure readers my book is only about 200 pages, so they didn't have to wade through quite so much detail. But he shows how Holocaust sites, not only in Kiev, but in Minsk, in Riga, all over Eastern Europe, particularly the large ones, were exhumed, including mass shootings or mass killings of prisoners of war, as well as of the Jews. And this was a major operation called Sonderkommando 1005. And it went right from the summer of 1943, more or less to the end of the war. And it does make it much harder to estimate things like numbers in graves, because they literally dug up all the bodies, burned them, ground them up, and left very little for history to kind of weigh up. But ironically, often that process does leave other evidence. And so in being able to sort of confirm that that happened, we then also get further corroboration of kind of the scale of the original crimes. And as I say, with Kiev, I was very lucky to get this aerial photograph, which shows the bunkers in which the prisoners were based when they were taken from the Syrians camp to work on the exhumation in 1943. Blobel was eventually tried in Nuremberg in the Einsatzgruppen trial, which the prosecution there was led by Ben Ferencz, a young Jewish prosecutor. And he was also executed. And I think if anyone deserved it, he was certainly given a fair trial and correctly executed.
Who were the survivors of the massacre? You have some pretty harrowing descriptions in the book of people that survived.
I was also surprised that there were quite so many descriptions of survivors, because I was aware of about sort of 5 or 10 when I started, but definitely got to more than 20, I would say, by the end. And it depends how you define survival. Some people were smart enough to turn back before they got to the first checkpoint, and obviously more of those survived, although survival is kind of a relative term, because you didn't just have to survive Babyn Yar in September 1941. You then also had to survive the whole Nazi occupation and the return of the Soviets afterwards. And some people who even survived the occupation would then be conscripted into the Red Army and maybe die fighting in Berlin. So it is hard to measure the total number of people who survived. But there were two main categories. A few managed to get kind of out of the columns on the way to Babyn Yar, and one or two were even could persuade guards that they were not Jewish and were taken out by car. That was more the exception. It certainly wasn't supposed to happen. Another group of non-Jews were sent to be shot, and we know about that because one of them was actually half Jewish, and she did manage to escape from the mass grave. And that's the other main category. Quite a few people did survive by crawling out of the mass grave. And this seems to be because of a slight change in procedure as it was getting dark. They did start shooting them from the very edge of the ravine. And this gave the opportunity for people to sort of jump in before the bullets hit them. And then those people were, some of them at least, were able to crawl out and make it to safety under cover of darkness. But even then, they were still running the gauntlet of whatever guards were left around and hoping to find some local population that would help them.
You mentioned a little bit about the cover-ups in the form of the exhumations, but can you talk a little bit about who was directing these cover-ups and why they were occurring? What was the objective here? Was it just to cover up the tracks of the massacres? How else did this take place?
What happened essentially is, from a very early stage, the Soviets started creating propaganda using the mass graves they uncovered in areas they reoccupied from the Germans. You see this actually in the war in Ukraine, where the Russians have been forced to retreat. You uncover mass graves, and that creates a lot of propaganda against the people who obviously created those mass graves. And so the Germans decided it was better to cover things up as best they could. And they did similar things even at the concentration camps in Kiev. It was a combined unit, a small group of the security police, another special commando led by Blobel. And also they had order police similar to the units that carried out the massacre regime. That was also a combined team of mainly security police, order police with some Waffen-SS. There weren't actually many German army personnel involved in the massacre, but they did create the framework for it, providing supplies and blowing up the sides of the ravine, these kind of things. So the Wehrmacht was also culpable, although most of the work is done by the security police and the order police. Similarly with the cover-up, they used prisoners from the Siretz camp, which was a large work education camp that had both Jewish and non-Jewish prisoners. Essentially, people were being rounded up for anything from suspected kind of spying or partisan activity, or being Jewish, or even refusing to work. You could end up in this camp. And mostly Jews were used for the exhumation squad. And for about 6 weeks, they literally dug up and burned certainly more than 30,000 corpses. Some estimates are quite a bit higher than that. And they could tell that the work was coming to an end. Even one of the guards tipped them off. So they managed to find the key to escape from their bunker, or one of the bunkers, among the property of the corpses. So this is an amazing story that you look through literally dozens of keys that are found in some people's pockets or on their persons. And you try them out, and they did find one that worked on just before they realized that they would probably be shot themselves. And then they organized a mass escape in the middle of the night, actually 2 years to the day after the massacre itself took place. And this escape of what I call shadows from the Valley of Death. So the German guards called them shadows because essentially their death sentence had already been signed, but a few of them did manage to get out and tell the story.
How did the Soviet Union attempt to make Babyn Yar disappear as a site of Jewish mourning? And why did they do this?
Essentially, the main reason was to do with the Soviet narrative of the war. They didn't want Jews to have a special status as kind of the chosen victims of the Nazis, but they had the ideology that all Soviet peoples suffered equally in the war. And initially, they didn't want any sort of memorial there, so they decided to redevelop it. I mean, there were other reasons, too. They needed more space for housing and other buildings around Kiev. They decided actually to put a major road through much of the ravine where even the shooting took place. And it is a problem even today that we wanted to put memorial stones where some of the key photographs were taken, and we managed to do that for several of them. But one of the most important photos, in fact, the one that's on the cover of the book, you can't put a stone there because there's a building there at the moment where people are living. So it just kind of shows you that the Soviet redevelopment really bore no kind of awareness or took no account of the history of the site. And in fact, when they did build a memorial after a lot of pressure was put on, they didn't mention kind of the Jewish nature of the victims, and they placed it quite a ways away, about at least 500 meters from where most of the events actually took place. And this carried on right up until the 1990s. Even under Gorbachev, they were kind of reluctant to stress that Jews were the main victims in Babyn Yar.
So located in Kiev, Babyn Yar is seeing war once again. What is the state of the site now, and how has the ongoing war in the Ukraine impacted your work?
So the site itself, I haven't been back there since the war started. I was last there on the 80th anniversary, which was about 6 months before the war, before the invasion took place. There was a missile fired at the television tower, very close to both the old Soviet memorial and parts of the ravine, and that did result in 5 deaths. And there was damage to one of the buildings that was intended to be part of the planned memorial site where one of the museum exhibits was to be. And that's also quite close to the Jewish Cemetery administrative building that was also planned to be renovated and become part of a series of different exhibits spread around the site. There was no real damage to other memorials or the ravine itself, but it is just terrible how the war has impacted every part of Ukraine. There was a Holocaust memorial in Kharkiv where literally a piece of the menorah Memorial itself was damaged. So the war has affected everyone in Ukraine terribly. And the main impact has been on the memorial center itself, which diverted its work almost entirely to humanitarian aid and investigating war crimes. We are still trying to record as many survivors of the massacre in 1941 as possible, as well as helping to do similar kind of work on the current war. But my position at the memorial effectively ended with the start of the war. My contract was cancelled because of a kind of military conflict, which has never happened to me before. It's a shame, but I still decided to finish the book basically on my own time, because it was just important that the story is told and that the book gets out in good time. My colleague Carol Berkoff is also writing a book with probably a similar aim, although I think his approach is bound to be different in several ways than mine. And there are other books coming out. But I think this one gives you the most detailed reconstruction of exactly what happened. And I try to do it in a dispassionate way, just so that we can understand what happened, that it makes sense, essentially.
What does Babinyar tell us about the nature of massacres, war crimes, and their memory?
So there are several lessons from Babinyar, although I think in many ways it was different from a lot of other even mass shootings or Holocaust events. And particularly shocking here was the fact that many of the victims had really no expectation, just the suddenness of the German occupation of Kiev and the kind of step towards massacres within the first 10 days was different from what happened in many other places where people were confined to ghettos, even in Riga, where they also shot 30,000 Jews within 10 days of each other in two shootings in the November. December of 1941. There they had experienced a lot of other tortures and events beforehand, such that there was no real expectation of something good coming from either the Latvian police or the Nazis. So the Jews were to some extent expecting what happened. But in Kiev, it was definitely a kind of a shock to the system. And the other surprising lesson for me was there were also similarities to the way that the extermination centers like Treblinka or Auschwitz or even a kind of non-permanent one like Bornaya Gora in Belarus operated, that you're kind of driving people into a narrow corridor so that there's no escape, and using quite a lot of brutality to make sure that it really works. And that is quite shocking, but it sort of shows that the gradual evolution of murder, that the difference between mass shooting and gassing is perhaps not that great in some ways, as the end is very much the same.
So with this book coming out, is there any other project that you're working on, other things that you're investigating, either with Babinyar or other subjects?
I still have some book publications in the pipeline about my own war crimes investigations. There was actually a book came out just last month about the British war crimes investigations, and there's almost kind of about 40 entries to my name. I do feel I have to tell my own side of the story. That book kind of stresses the unsatisfactory outcome and in some ways blames the legal system for not being suited to these kind of war crimes. I think that's being a little unfair given the legal position that we really couldn't go after people without eyewitness evidence, and that made the job much harder. So to compare it with, say, American investigations where more than 100 people were denaturalized or deported is a little tricky because they have a very different legal system with different rules of evidence. And I'm actually still very proud of that work. I think we did the best that we could. The one area where they may have actually got it a bit right was that we certainly could have carried on the investigation a bit longer and maybe at least knocked on a few more doors, that the numbers of people who were in these local police units that came to the West was definitely much higher than people expected. And that was one of my findings, both really with all the war crimes units that I worked with, that often you would find that it wasn't just one or two, but in the case of the Mir police, which was just a small town in Belarus with 4,000 or 5,000 inhabitants, as many as 40 members of that police unit came to the UK, which is kind of shocking to think that so many from one small village is in Britain. How many came from other villages? And that's definitely a good question.
That's certainly frightening. Well, Martin, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. The book is Investigating Babinyar, Shadows from the Valley of Death. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Gabe. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.